To be a prophet is to be absolutely captivated and convicted by God's plans and God's power. Jeremiah was a prophet. When called upon to speak a word of divine blessing, he refused to commit himself to saying only what would make his listeners feel good. Instead, he was committed and confined to speaking strictly and exclusively the words that God gave him, whether the people in power liked what he said or not. And so it was that Jeremiah found himself in jail. He had refused to say that God approved of the king's plans. The king got angry. Jeremiah got locked up. But Jeremiah was not the only one trapped. The king and the royal court, and in fact, all of the people of the city were in a prison of their own because they were surrounded by the enemy troops of Babylon. They were besieged for the long term, effectively, and without much hope for survival. Everybody in the city was starting to see what Jeremiah had been seeing and saying all along. They were about to be overrun, trampled, and defeated. They were about to experience the consequences of their grievous behavior. And if you think that Jeremiah was taking this moment to proclaim, "I told you so," you would be wrong. To be a prophet does not mean to be angry and vengeful. It means to have your heart broken by the way people all around you tend to self-destruct and do harm to others, even when God is standing by to offer love and guidance and support for a better way. To be a prophet usually means to be totally out of sync with what everyone else is saying and doing. And so, as the people of the city seeing finally the truth that disaster was at hand and began to sell their possessions and prepare to flee or to try to bribe their way to safety, Jeremiah was being urged by God to display hope. I'm going to read to you from Jeremiah 32, verses 6 through 15. Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me. Hanamel, son of your uncle Shallum, is going to come to you and say, 'Buy my field that is at Anathoth, for the right of redemption by purchase is yours.' Then my cousin Hanamel did come to me in the court of the guard in accordance with the word of the Lord and said to me, 'Buy my field that is at Anathoth in the land of Benjamin, for the right of possession and redemption is yours. Buy it for yourself.' Then I knew this was the word of the Lord. And I bought the field at Anathoth from my cousin Hanamel and weighed out the money to him, 17 shekels of silver. I signed the deed, sealed it, got witnesses, and weighed the money on scales. I took the sealed deed of purchase containing the terms and conditions and the open copy, and I gave the deed of purchase to Baruch, son of Neriah, son of Messiah, in the presence of my cousin Hanamel, in the presence of the witnesses who signed the deed of purchase, and in the presence of all the Judeans who were sitting in the court of the guard. In their presence I charged Baruch, saying, 'Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, take these deeds, both this sealed deed of purchase and this open deed, and put them in an earthenware jar, in order they may last for a long time. For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall again be bought in this land.'" What you just heard were the details of a property transaction inspired by God. Everybody else was desperate to ditch their holdings in what would soon be a ruined city in a ruined country. Jeremiah, given the opportunity according to the land ownership rules of the time, had the first right of purchase or refusal. So he bought the property and he put it, the deed to the property, in the equivalent of the safe deposit box of that time. He was planning for the distant future in which God would help people to reclaim and rebuild their city and their land. He was preparing for something that nobody else could yet see. The end which loomed before them was not actually the final ending. God would one day bring renewal, and rebirth, new life, and new livelihood. I thought about Jeremiah this month when I met a guy named Jim in the town of Anaconda in Montana. Anaconda was once a thriving city, very proud of its contribution to the electrification and the industrialization of America through its steadfast labor in the mining and smelting and shipping of copper. The smokestack of the smelter remains a cherished landmark and a monument to this day, although the smelter itself has been closed for at least 3 decades. The population of Anaconda has plummeted since the time of the final mine closure and smelting closure, leaving many empty homes and empty commercial buildings. In Anaconda, it is possible to buy a piece of land with a falling down house on it for $10,000 as long as you pay cash. Besides the smokestack, the other unmissable landmark is a huge pile of mine tailings, which the locals claim make a good alternative to sand for sand traps if you happen to be building a golf course, but the EPA has designated as a Superfund cleanup site. I met Jim because he was giving the history tour of the town of Anaconda. Every day at 10 o'clock and at 2 o'clock, every day in the months between the snowmelt in the spring and the first snowfall sometime in September, Jim, or one of the other 2 volunteers certified by the Chamber of Commerce, is standing by in case anybody shows up. If they get customers, they load their visitors onto a vintage 1936 tour bus, originally used at Glacier National Park, and they make a circuit of the town, showing off the city park and the greenhouse, the fish hatchery, first in the state of Montana, the ball field, the gorgeous movie theater that was built in the 1930s, and the interiors of a couple of hanging on by the thread local churches. The famous hotel has been defaced and is now closed. The last of the breweries is closed. And in those cases, as with the buildings that were affiliated with the mine, we just drive by and we don't go in. There's nothing really to see and it wouldn't be safe. Jim, like Jeremiah, seems to be living his life against the tide. He grew up in the area when it was in its prime, everything operating at full tilt. When he graduated high school, he left town, wanting evidently to have some adventures. And so he worked a lot of different jobs in a lot of different places, from California to Oklahoma. 3 years ago, he retired, and he came back to his decimated hometown of Anaconda to live. Is Jim a prophet? I don't know. His voice is so soft that you have to lean really close and concentrate to hear what he says. But it's clear from his actions that he loves his town. And although it might look to others like the town is dying, for Jim it remains a place of life. He was eager to point out the 2 different weddings taking place the day of our tour, told us all about the community festivals and the kids in the schools. Prophet or not, there is little doubt that Jim has found his place of service. He's literally been entrusted with the keys to every building in the city, and he offers all of his guests and visitors a strikingly memorable experience. Some people in the world have the gift of rushing forward whenever and wherever they see someone in need of compassion and care. One descriptive name for people like this is lovers. Luke, who authored 1 of the 4 Gospels, reveals some of the characteristics of a lover. Luke adores the stories of Jesus, which encourage us to notice when people around us are suffering, and which celebrate those who stop to offer help, in contrast to the many who have a habit of just walking on by. He includes in his gospel at least 1 story of this nature, which none of the others managed to remember or incorporate. It's a story of a rich man who ignored a poor beggar at his gate. You may remember hearing it before. It begins like this, and I'm in Luke chapter 16, beginning with verse 19. And this is Jesus, according to Luke, Jesus telling this story. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. And the story continues that the man who was so successful at disregarding the poor beggar ends up in a place of fiery torment. And Lazarus ends up cradled in the arms of his ancestors. So now it's the other man's turn to beg for relief. But he's told in the story it's too late. The chasm between the two has been fixed and it can no longer be crossed. And so through this story, we're cautioned to not let our actions contribute to the establishment of such a great divide. We're encouraged to take action and do something to alleviate suffering before we miss our chance. You can go ahead and read the rest of that story sometime later today and see if it inspires you. But for examples of how to seize the moment and proactively respond to the hurting human beings around us, we can look to the lovers among us. In his book called God Hides in Plain Sight, Dean Nelson tells a story of a man named Julio who got mugged on his way to dinner one evening. It had been a really long day at work, and when Julio stepped off the subway onto an empty platform and started down the deserted stairs, a teenager appeared and approached him in a menacing way, waving a knife, and demanded Julio's wallet. Julio handed over the wallet, and the teen started to run away. But Julio called out, "Hey, wait a minute, you forgot something. If you're going to spend the rest of the night robbing people, you might as well take my coat to keep you warm." The kid stopped running. He turned around. "What?" he exclaimed. "Why would you give me your coat?" "Hey, if you're willing to risk your freedoms for just a few dollars, I guess you must really need the money. I was on my way to get dinner. If you want to join me, you're more than welcome." The teenage boy accepted the invitation. And at the diner, the boy was startled that people kept coming by the table to greet Julio. "Do you own this place?" he asked. "No," explained Julio. "I just eat here a lot." "But you're nice to everybody, even the dishwasher," the kid observed. "Well, isn't that what you were taught?" asked Julio. "Well, yeah," admitted the boy, "but I didn't think people actually behaved that way." Apparently, he had never seen kindness and consideration in action. After the meal, Julio said, "Well, I guess you're going to have to pay for dinner because you're the one with the wallet. But if you want to give it back to me, I would gladly treat you." The boy handed back the wallet. Julio paid the bill, and he slipped the boy a 20. "How about you give me that knife, too?" suggested Julio. And the former mugger did so. A chasm of fear and separation had been avoided. A relationship of care and trust had formed instead. It cannot be lack of opportunity that prevents us from serving others, observes Professor Dean Nelson at the conclusion of that story about Julio and his new friend. Opportunity is all around us and at our very doorstep. Dean himself remembers with gratitude the neighbor who came to his home when his son was small and a medical condition required the little boy to be in a body cast. This elderly neighbor would come over and sit in a chair and bat a balloon back and forth above the child who was laying on his back on the floor. And the little boy would laugh and laugh with delight. My neighbor did not need a sociology, child development, or ballooning degree, Dean points out. She just needed a heart that was willing to get involved. The Apostle Paul's carefully considered wisdom and advice from 1 Timothy chapter 6 is that we become rich in good works. whatever our temperament, whatever our way of apprehending God, plenty of avenues of service lie open before us. Today is a day for stepping forward in faith. Along with MS walkers and AIDS HIV walkers, along with mystics and prophets and sages and lovers in every place, along with people grieving and people rejoicing, we join our voices and represent our prayers in the prayer that Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever.